Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
The result of Labour's policy is seen in the health of the people, especially of the children and of the babies.
That all the tides of history are flowing in our direction. We are not beaten. We represent the future.
The Britain that is going to be forged in the white heat of this revolution will be no place for restrictive...
The trade unions are vital to the Labour movement. It was the trade unions that created the Labour movement.
I've seen more press coverage since we've been active on the subject of black involvement in Labour politics than I've ever seen before.
And you end in the grotesque chaos of a Labour council hiring taxis to scale around...
People don't know what the Labour Party is about at all.
A new dawn has broken, has it not?
If anyone says that politics can't make a difference, then look at what we have achieved together.
People feel that change is coming.
Ed Miliband has a dream. He wants to revive Labour as a mass membership party.
I want to use your talents, whoever you supported.
Ed Miliband has stepped down as Labour Party leader. The announcement comes after a devastating night for the party.
Jeremy Corbyn, 251.
Come with us on that journey.
The Labour Party is too broad a church at the moment.
You'll be inspired.
There are people who disagree with me for reasons that they say are to do, say, with Iraq.
You'll be occupied.
But actually are to do with the fact that I won three elections to the Labour Party and they didn't like it.
But above all, you'll be part of it.
Hello and welcome to the Beginner's Guide to the Labour Party. My name is Holly Rigby. I'm a relatively new member of the Labour Party. I joined in September 2015 after Jeremy Corbyn was elected, and I'm definitely a beginner at all of this. So if you are too and want to find out more about the Labour Party, keep listening. To help me understand how all of this works, each month I'll be putting my questions to a panel of experts. We'll be going in depth to understand the inner workings and history of the Labour Party, and I'll be challenging my guests to break down the jargon. I'm here with a regular guest as well, Jeremy Gilbert. Do you want to introduce yourself, Jeremy?
Hi, I'm Jeremy Gilbert. I'm an academic based at the University of East London, and I'm active in the Labour Party in various ways and with connections to both Momentum and Compass, two different organisations.
Great. So in this episode, we're talking about the history of the different factions in the Labour Party. We're currently in the middle of a Labour leadership contest, and these factions seem to really come out in the open. And I think lots of new members like myself will be wondering, where did they come from? What do they believe? And which ones are at play in the contest between Jeremy Corbyn and Owen Smith? So this month, we're joined by special guests Ellie Mae O'Hagan and Luke Akehurst. And I'll let you guys introduce yourselves.
I'm Ellie Mae O'Hagan. I guess I used to work for the unions for a very long time, Unite, which is Labour's biggest donor. So I have that connection to the Labour Party. But at the moment, I'm mainly known for being a journalist, writing mainly for The Guardian. And I write a lot about the Labour Party. You might say exclusively about the Labour Party at the moment.
Yeah, I'm Luke Akehurst. I've been active in the Labour Party since I was 16, which is 28 years, which is feels like far too long. I'm the secretary of a group called Labour First, which I'm sure I'll be asked to explain a bit about later on. Former councillor in Hackney for 12 years, parliamentary candidate a couple of times, been on the Labour Party National Executive, and I write a column for Labour List, which is exclusively about inner workings of the Labour Party, really.
Great. So this episode is all about the factions in the Labour Party. But before we start, what do we mean by factions? Jeremy, do you think you can define it for us?
Yeah, well, a faction is a grouping within an organisation or a movement which has a particular political agenda which is distinctive from those of others within the same organisation or movement. They can be more or less organisationally coherent. So it's possible to talk about a faction as a kind of loose network of affiliates, or it's possible to talk about a faction as an actually, you know, organised grouping. But broadly speaking, that's what it means.
Yeah. I mean, the thing I was going to say is that historically, the Labour Party, whilst it's had kind of factions and currents, they've been a lot less strong than in other social democratic and democratic socialist parties. That if you went to Australia, for instance, you can't actually join without taking out a card that says you're a member of a state faction. So the Victoria State Left or the New South Wales Right, everyone is in one. And similarly in France, they actually kind of measure the number of people on the party executive by the strength of the factions at the party conference. It's a lot less formal than that historically in the Labour Party. And my guess is that about 98%, and until very recently, about 98% of Labour Party members would not have been on the mailing lists of any factional organisation. It was like a minority pastime for people that were very, very active.
I think that's still true, probably. That proportion is probably still about right. I don't think Momentum have got enough, a big enough proportion for that to be wrong.
So when we're talking about factions within the Labour Party, we're talking not necessarily about organised groups of people. We're talking about people who share a coalition of ideas as opposed to an organised group.
So there are broad kind of traditions in the party, which some people would feel an affiliation to the kind of history of them and some wouldn't. And then within those, there's probably smaller groups of people that are very interested in organisation and in the nuts and bolts of how the party works, that actually kind of get involved in organising this stuff. But there's loads of people that, yeah, there are loads of MPs or councillors that manage their entire time in the Labour Party without ever feeling that they particularly want a badge put on them. I mean, I had a conversation with Ed Miliband when he was leader. He said, I resent the idea that I have to choose between left or right of the party. I don't feel connected to either of them.
Okay, so I think maybe once we start talking about the different factions, it might become more obvious how they work within the Labour Party. So could you explain what are the different main factions in the Labour Party and how have they emerged?
Okay, so I think... that there are probably four broad traditions that you could identify in the Labour Party. So from the right to the left, you would have a kind of Blairite or New Labour tradition, which the organisation Progress would be the main organisational aspect of. And the bizarre thing is that didn't actually come out the historic right of the Labour Party. A lot of how New Labour and the Blairites emerged was actually an ideological journey that people in the 1980s had thought of themselves as on the soft left, went on a kind of journey and ended up in a different place. Then, by some criteria to the left of that, but by others not, is a grouping that you could kind of call the traditional old right, which maybe someone like Tom Watson would fit into. Certainly Michael Duggar of MPs would fit easily into that tradition, which is kind of looks back to the right wing of the party or the moderate wing of the party that existed before Tony Blair, the Dennis Healey or Roy Hattersley type tradition. Then you've got a group whose boundaries can kind of vary on both the left and the right flanks, that you could call the soft left, which Compass used to be the main organisational hub of, and now there's a group called Open Labour, but I'm not sure in group terms it's that strong, but probably it's where a very large slice of Labour MPs and councillors feel they belong. So that kind of came out of the Tribune group of MPs and Nye Bevan's left wing in the 50s, and through Michael Foot and Neil Kinnock and people like that. And then On the left, you've got what nowadays people say Corbynites or Momentum or whatever, sometimes called the hard left to differentiate them from the soft left. That wasn't intended to be a pejorative term. It was just the way things were described back in the 80s, who would be the kind of less compromising left, who now, to their surprise, find themselves kind of in the driving seat of the party when historically, or at least for the last 30 years, they'd been kind of at the margins.
Okay, so that gives a sense of the spectrum, I suppose. And I think it'd be useful for listeners to know where you all come from within that spectrum, knowing what the factions are. So, Ellie, can you start off? Which of those factions would you say you're part of and why?
I would say that I'm part of the left faction, although the funny thing is there's actually factions within the left as well. So, for example, you've got an MP like Ian Lavery, who I would also say is on the left, but he is sort of distinct from someone like Jeremy Corbyn. Like, Ian Lavery and Jeremy Corbyn didn't have much of a relationship that I know of. Maybe, I don't know whether you want to correct me on that, Luke. But they are two people that I would say are both on the left of the party. So I would say that I'm on the left because I believe in things like state ownership of public services. I'm opposed to Trident renewal. I oppose the war in Iraq. I guess, you know, those are the, I'm interested in sort of social equality. Although having said that, so are the Blairite faction. So that's not exactly totally distinct. And things like a very strong interventionist welfare state. All of those things would put me on the left of the party.
Okay, and Jeremy?
Well, I mean, I would say that sort of institutionally, traditionally, I was on the soft left. And for a long time, I was a member of Compass. You know, I sort of considered myself a Kinnockite in the late 80s when I was, you know, when I was a teenager. But I was always kind of on, I would say, I was always on the kind of left of the soft left, as it were. And now I just think the distinction, now I think, I completely agree with Luke's topology and history, but I think really just over the past couple of years, it's been clear the kind of boundary between that left of the soft left and the kind of Benite hard left has pretty much dissolved. Yeah, you know, as you know, a lot of support, for a lot of Corbyn support is people like me who would have voted for Ed Miliband, for example, who now, you know, who just think that project, that tradition is pretty much finished. And that current was all, but that current, what I would call the left of the soft left, I realise this is complicating things a bit, but that left was always characterised by a position which was sort of strategic in its understanding of parliamentary politics and sort of sympathetic to a kind of centrist agenda in terms of parliamentary politics, but was also always interested in extra parliamentary politics, in the idea of movement politics and kind of community and street activism as complementary to that. So it was always fairly complicated, and that strand of it, I think, was always kind of, I think there are fairly contingent historical reasons why that strand of it wasn't allied to the sort of Benite hard left. So I think in some ways it's not that much of a shift in the position for it now to be allied to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of interesting because it's all, almost like the soft left has sort of dissolved into component bits, because the obviously I'm looking at things from a perspective of the other end of the party. What I had been seeing is loads of people that I had assumed were coming from a different place to me are now backing the same leadership candidate. And actually, I'm backing Owen Smith, who I perceive to be on the left of the soft left, as a leadership candidate. And the other choice was Angela Eagle, who I always thought, yeah, I didn't even know that Angela Eagle supported Trident or that Maria Eagle supported Trident until last September, when it suddenly turned out that I agreed with them on things. So I just presumed culturally they were from somewhere out in a different bit of the party to me. And you suddenly find yourself kind of allied with people like Peter Hain or Tom Copley from the London Assembly, who 3 years ago I was debating against him at local Labour parties was him as the left person, and now he seems to be saying exactly the same stuff as me. So it's become a lot more, in terms of the discourse on social media and stuff, it's become a lot more having to choose one option or another. I don't think that's sustainable or healthy, really. At some point in the future, when there isn't a leadership election on, people will start to take more nuanced positions.
At some point in the next 50 years when there isn't a leadership election. Yeah.
In terms of where I come from, when I first joined the party, I would have identified as a Kinnockite. Then you kind of, as you get more involved, you get to meet different sorts of people. And the tradition that I would identify with nowadays is the kind of tradition that is like the old right or the old moderate set of people, because I've got views that were people in Momentum would probably find quite obnoxious in terms of where I stand on defence or security policy. I'm very sort of passionate about defence and the relationship with America. There are people that kind of share that passion, but are probably very uncomfortable about Iraq. I'm probably in a minority in terms of my views on Iraq now, whether that's on the right or the left of the party. But what differentiates the kind of traditional moderates from the more Blairite ones is an affection for the trade unions. So like a kind of deep engage. In fact, a lot of our key people would have come out of working for trade unions or being heavily involved in trade unions. A lot of involvement usually in municipal life, in local governments. Usually more provincial than London based, though I was in Hackney, so I'm exception to that rule. And quite traditional in terms of social and economic policy. So basically, I'm an old fashioned social democrat that wants, in terms of internal policies, I want Britain to look like Sweden, or like Sweden did in its heyday. I'm not really into like marketization of. In fact, I'm massively opposed to and will argue against marketization of public services and some of those things that were associated with the tail end of the Blair era. But I kind of have no problem working with people that would self-describe as Blairite. We'll kind of have little arguments and stuff. Mm. But
so you guys have kind of outlined some of the ideas that characterise the factions that you're in. But I think what's difficult for a new member to understand is what factions actually do as well, because I think that if you watch the media coverage, there seems to be two big factions, like the Blairites and the Corbynites. Like, that seems to be the battle that you kind of hear about all the time. And my perspective is like the Blairites always sound like this secret cabal who kind of, you know, are meeting up and organizing to do certain things, and the Corbynites are kind of doing the same thing but in a bigger, like more protesty movement way. What do factions do apart from having a shared set of ideas? Do they meet up and have these meetings about things they want to get done in the Labour Party? And what has being in a faction meant that you have actually done, if you know what I mean, as part of those factions?
That really varies from case to case and from situation to situation. And I mean, the most organised type of factionalising involves actually organising at various, whatever level you're operating at, whether it's local politics or national politics or in student politics or the unions, actually organising, actually caucusing, as it's, I think it says something about, actually, Luke is completely right, that there's kind of the traditional distaste and a kind of disavowal of the existence of factional politics in British politics, because caucusing is a word most people don't know, whereas in American politics, everybody knows what caucusing means. It's when your faction gets together and tries to say its factional agenda and then works out a plan for how it's going to implement that agenda within the wider organisation. So, at the most organised level, factions will actually get together. They will work out how they are going to try to, for example, secure their agenda in their local Labour Party, how they're going to get their position, how they're going to organise slates for things like the National Executive Committee or for local committees like the General Committee of the Constituency Party. On the other hand, factions can be much looser than that. I mean, so for example, I mean, the soft left, for example, hasn't actually had an organisation that did that for a very long time. Not really since the emergence of New Labour. And Compass sort of toyed with the idea that when Compass first emerged, it was a sort of attempt to reconvene the soft left. But it never got to the point of, for example, organising local caucuses, organising national slates. It did get to the point of officially nominating and supporting Ed Miliband, for example, but it wasn't an affiliated part of the party, so it couldn't do that. I think, in some ways, I would say the ideal typical example of a faction in the party right now is probably Labour First. I don't say that in any kind of insulting way. So maybe Luke can talk a bit about what Labour First does.
Yeah. So as the person that's secretary of Labour First, I mean, we would have an aspiration that purely for reactive reasons, because there are local momentum groups, we think we've probably got to start organising at that kind of local level to give people a kind of space where they can discuss where they think the party's going and agree on, you know, what needs to be done at a local level. That really doesn't exist outside of a handful of places. I think there's about four places in the entire country where people have that kind of those kind of meetings. So we look shambolically disorganized compared to momentum. And then
you may have a fantasy about how organised Momentum is. I'm not sure there's more than.
Well, I think it varies from place to place. So the sort of stuff that we do is we come up with a list of names for any nationwide ballots. So for the National Executive Committee, we sit down with Progress. I don't think it's a huge secret that when Tony Blair was or Gordon Brown was leader, we would have sat down with the leader's office as well and worked out who were the six people that we wanted to back. And presumably Jeremy's political secretary sits down with Momentum and discusses that. And similarly for the National Policy Forum, below that level, it's a lot less formalised than that. I mean, most people would be horrified if you said to them, here's a Labour First line or whatever at a local meeting. The way I've observed that historically it tends to operate is you have a small number of people, often just one on each side, or maybe one on one side and no one on the other side in each constituency party. You actually know what's going on at a national level, that they're highly involved in this stuff. They're on all the email lists. They follow all the right websites and stuff. And that will be the guy. So in Hackney North, it used to be me on one side and a man called Graham Bash on the left. And we would be the ones that would stand up and say, I suggest we nominate these six candidates, or I suggest we support this motion, or I propose person X for membership secretary. And it would really just be, people wouldn't see themselves as, I am a member of the left, or I am a member of the moderate side. They would just go, well, I kind of trust Luke's judgment more than Graham's, or Graham's more than Luke's. And it worked kind of like that, because most people, they don't recognise the names off the NEC ballot or whatever, unless when Ken Livingstone was standing, it was obviously different. But the name recognition of those of us that run for that is we're not household names in our own households.
Yeah, I agree. Like when I got in, because I'm a Corbyn supporter and part of Momentum, and I just got an email saying these are the people you should vote for the NEC, and I just did it because I thought that was like part of what was happening. So I definitely recognised that process, having been part of like the party myself. But thinking about Jeremy Corbyn and Owen Smith in some senses, how did Jeremy Corbyn get nominated and now has become the leader of the party? Is that as a result of a well-organised faction?
No. This might be where we disagree, like the panellists, because I think that my take on how Jeremy got elected, well, and won, was that basically there was a sense in the party that the left should be represented, and it was a bit of a kind of patronising, like, let's give them their kind of 5 minutes sort of attitude. And I think there was also a sense that, like, let him stand and then he'll be crushed and then it'll silence the left once and for all. I think Luke actually said that.
I thought that was going to happen. I argued in favour of Jeremy being on the ballot paper because I really thought the only impact would be in terms of how it would affect the relative first preference votes of the different moderate candidates. I had absolutely no idea that there was this constituency of opinion that would really love him out in the country. I just didn't think that there were that many people in the UK that had those views. So, good for him that he's gone and found them, but it was a big shock to me.
I will say though, I was in the same boat as Luke. I mean, obviously, not that I said let's put him up so we can crush the left. Like that wasn't my view. But I did think that he would be annihilated. And one of the reasons why initially I was supportive of his candidacy and supported efforts to get him to win was because I wanted the left to end in third place, because I thought if we don't come last, then at least it will show that there is left-wing opinion in the party and we can't be ignored. And that was what I was aiming for. And it really did blindside me as much as it blindsided everybody else. And my feeling about why Jeremy got elected wasn't because the left was such a strong and well-organized faction, because believe me, as someone who's been to 10,000 left rallies on the Labour Party with the same 20 people at them every time, it's not. I think that actually the Labour membership is much, much further to the left, than I think any of us realised. And in fact, over 50% of existing Labour members voted for Corbyn. It wasn't his support, what didn't come from the outside, it came from within existing members. Also because the membership had shifted in terms of its makeup under Miliband as well. It became more left-wing and younger. So I think my take on what happened was that the left had been very, very marginalised for a very, very long time in the party and had kind of done what it was told to do by voting in Ed Miliband, someone who was soft left and could appear electable. And then that election was lost. And there was this kind of feeling amongst Corbyn supporters that I spoke to, which ran into their hundreds by the end of the leadership campaign because I wrote about it so much. There was this sort of feeling of, well, we voted for the candidate that you told us to vote for and we've still got a Tory government. So now we're just going to vote for someone who basically has principles that we share. And also, I think the other thing to remember about the leadership election is that the other three candidates, their campaigns were really abysmal. And I say that as someone who went to so many of their rallies. And I originally had decided to vote for Andy Burnham because of the reasons that I just mentioned about Corbyn. And then changed my mind later when I thought, oh, I better support the left candidate. But originally, I wasn't really like very sort of enthusiastic about Jeremy. But then the leadership campaigns from the other three candidates were just so empty and meaningless. They really didn't feel like there was much to vote for. And I think that was another reason why Corbyn ended up winning. I think it was a kind of tinderbox situation, a big wave, something that came out of the blue. It definitely wasn't the result of an organised faction. The left has been very disorganised in the Labour Party for a very long time.
And has that changed now as a result of Jeremy being the leader? Because you've got momentum now, and they obviously are organising within the Labour Party. So are they a new faction that's come out that is now in battle with these kind of older factions? Is that what's happening with the kind of crisis that's happening right now?
That's largely what's happened. I mean, one of the things that's happened is there was a kind of existing hard left Bennite faction, which has provided a lot of the infrastructure for Momentum locally, nationally. That's the LRC, the Labour Representation Committee, which is John McDonnell's political base in the party, is organised around the hard left magazine Labour Briefing. And they sort of took it up, although it wouldn't... I completely agree with what everybody said about how this happened. They were not really involved. They were barely involved at all in organising his leadership campaign. They were just the only people around who were kind of even... who had a kind of network, who were able to pick up any of the kind of organisational slack, you know, as the campaign developed. So that has happened. So they... Momentum has... is what you have just described. Although, Momentum is partly an ongoing attempt to answer the question, well, what do we do with these like hundreds of thousands of people who suddenly emerged out of political inactivity in order to support Jeremy's campaign for the leadership? And I would say it's probably going too far to say that Momentum itself is exactly sure like what the answer to that question is. It is an ongoing attempt to answer the question. And it hasn't really had time to do anything much apart from, you know, organise a round of rallies to support Jeremy in 2015 and another round now. So, but insofar as it is organising locally, I mean, what Luke said is accurate. I mean, it is also organising in much the same way as traditional Labour factions do. It organised a slate for the NEC, etc. But even Momentum has been largely reactive so far. Largely, it's been a reaction to the fact that, indeed, this constituency of opinion has emerged, which I think, like everyone, I was amazed and shocked by Jeremy getting the leadership. I wasn't so amazed by that body of opinion existing, because there's something as a sort of cultural studies teacher of cultural studies, one thing I do almost every year is read over the British Social Attitude Surveys. And I've been saying to people for years, if you study the British Social Attitude Surveys, it was pretty clear that about 20 to 25% of the population will give a basically Marxist answer to most questions about their beliefs, about how the world works. And so, and since the mid-80s, that body of opinion had largely acquiesced to the idea that it couldn't be represented politically, that it would be futile to try to seek political representation, that it had to accept the leadership of the Labour right in order to have to secure any kind of political or electoral success. And that the disappointments with Blairism, for just the reasons Luke set out, actually, the marketisation of public services in particular, I think even more than Iraq, and then the failure of a Miliband strategy meant that body of opinion kind of re-emerged very, very quickly as the kind of basis for momentum and for Jeremy's leadership. But I think, momentum, as I say, is a sort of work in progress, and there is, and it is not entirely clear in its own mind collectively what is the answer to the question. What are we supposed to do with these hundreds of thousands of people who have emerged quite quickly into some degree of political activity, who after just being quite dormant for a generation?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So if that's Jeremy Corbyn, then where does Owen Smith factor into all of this? Because kind of following it in the media, it looked like it was Blairites who instigated the coup and then obviously got a large swathe of support from the Labour Party generally. Then Owen Smith appeared and he's kind of presenting himself as this more acceptable face of kind of like left-wing politics. So it hasn't been clear how factions have been kind of operating in this particular time, given who started the coup, but now who's the candidate. So maybe just start with the coup itself. Was that the process of the Blairites saying, right, we're going to get organised now, he needs to go, and let's make this happen?
I think there are three different sets of people in the PLP who kind of map across to the factions in the country that, or currents in the country we were talking about, who had different attitudes to Corbyn. So the first set was the people that you could accurately historically describe as Blairite, who decided not to serve immediately in September. So starting with Jamie Reid during Corbyn's speech, and then Chukwuemeka, though he's someone that actually came out of the soft left, but by 2015 is a kind of Blairite character, Liz Kendall, etc., who just said, we're not interested in giving credibility to this guy's leader, we're not going to take front bench offices. So there was a first set of people, and they actually took some of the right wing of the Brownites with them as well. So Yvette Cooper and Rachel Reeves from the start decided they weren't going to serve, though in Rachel's case it's a bit more ambiguous because she was going on maternity leave, so I'm not quite sure how much of it was personal and how much of it was political. Then you had a set of people basically organized by kind of Tom Watson and Andy Burnham, who you could broadly say were kind of Brownites or kind of old right or something like that, or the right wing of the soft left, who decided they were going to try and make it work. They probably, I talked to these people, I don't think that they thought that Jeremy Corbyn was going to make it to the general election, but they just kind of thought you kind of have to accept that he just got a big mandate. The Labour Party's got to motor along. Someone's got to provide a front bench for this guy. We'll try and work with him. And they tried to do a deal where they said, yeah, give front bench jobs to some of the guys that are aligned with us. Don't touch our policy red lines around, yeah, particularly around Trident. But you can run with all the anti-austerity stuff. We accept that you've got a mandate to run with anti-austerity and we'll sing along with that. But that fell apart very quickly when it came to the Syria question was the first break point. And then the sacking of Michael Duggar in the reshuffle that happened just after the new year, annoyed a set of MPs that really liked Michael that would drink with him or go to the tea room with him or whatever. They were like, okay, he got rid of our mate. We're not interested anymore. But they stayed in for quite a long time. I think that those people were not the Blairite set of people wanted a contest against Jeremy anyway. The old right people would have had a division about whether to carry on for another couple of years and see how it all panned out and basically be pragmatic about it. And then you had a kind of soft left set of people who, in policy terms, don't actually have that much problem with Jeremy Corbyn at all. So Owen Smith himself, Lisa Nandy, Lillian Greenwood, Fangam Debonair, Chianwara, you could go for a whole list of people who it's very difficult to see in policy terms where they would disagree with Jeremy. But they're sort of more pragmatic in terms of do they need to compromise a bit to win elections? And then their reason, their break point was over what they perceived to be competence issues in terms of the way that he had managed them as people and the way in which he managed the European referendum campaign. So I don't think those people were necessarily going to do anything. If the referendum had gone the other way, I think then nothing would have happened and probably nothing would have happened next year because there's not really an important set of council elections next year in the way that there was this year. And the referendum provided a trigger point for some people that had always wanted, you could call it a coup, contest, whatever you want to call it, and then other people that didn't really want one because they wanted a quiet life, but it provoked them into going for one.
So you sort of answered really about Owen Smith, that he's from the soft left, that actually like on policy positions, he kind of would come into this soft left set of ideas. So what is his faction then? It's this big nebulous group, and who's supporting him and what are they doing to sort of organise around supporting Owen Smith to be the candidate?
I would put Owen Smith somewhere in the region of Ed Miliband in terms of his politics. Kind of, you know, like he's sort of broadly in favour of immigration, but will occasionally say things that he shouldn't about immigration to appeal to voters. You know, he sort of is in favour of welfare state, but again, will say things that suggest that he isn't because of it will appeal to voters, you know. And so I would put him in that category. That's where he sits. I think that he's tacking a lot to the left at the moment. He's trying because I think he recognises that that's what the electorate, the Labour electorate, want. I think that the Blairite faction, which is actually quite small, but it's just very vocal. That's why it appears big, is because it's very vocal and it has a lot of contact in the lobby. So that's why often when you get anonymous briefings slagging off Jeremy Corbyn, it's the Blairite faction doing it because they've got contacts with lobby journalists and so they appear bigger than they are. I do think they have recognised that they can't put up a Blairite candidate because they just look what happened to Liz Kendall. It just won't work. So I think they've reluctantly coalesced around Owen Smith. So I think basically Owen Smith's support is everyone and anyone who wants Jeremy out at this point. And he is the not Jeremy candidate is how I would describe him. And I think that's why he'll lose as well. And I just want to say as well, what Luke said then about the kind of timeline of the coup and the different factions. I think one of the biggest mistakes that Corbyn supporters make when discussing the coup with me is they say that, you know, it's a coup that's been orchestrated by the PLP, who've always hated Jeremy and always want him out, and it's a coup, is Blairites versus Corbynites. And so you'd think that someone like me would listen to Luke's version of events and say it's inaccurate, but actually I think it's, from what I understand from having spoken to a lot of different MPs and having followed the thing very closely, actually that's a very accurate description of what's happened. And I think that we really need to stop talking about the PLP versus Jeremy and the Blairites versus the Corbynites, because actually things are much more complicated in the Labour Party than that.
So you've outlined the different factions, but as a new member, it's not clear whether this is as a result of this moment or whether historically there's always been these faction fights within the Labour Party. So could you explain a little bit about the history of these factions, whether the factions are inevitable part of being in the Labour Party?
Okay. I don't think they're an inevitable part of life at the grassroots level in the Labour Party. I think there are many, many constituencies that have managed for years and years and years, often because they're not big enough to sustain factions. I mean, if you're to not really have internal factionalisation, it tends to just be like there's only just enough of us to deliver all the leaflets. So we disagree about things, but we're not. There aren't enough people to contest internal elections at many lower levels of the Labour Party, and you've got enough trouble on your hand fighting the Tories without fighting each other. So it's tended to be an inner urban thing, from particularly from London, but Liverpool, Manchester, Birmingham as well, that have always had factional activity and then a national level thing, that people that don't look that factional can turn up at party conference and feel that they're aligned with something. So it's not inevitable that you have to feel I've got to be part of one thing or the other. You can just be happy being Labour, and there are a lot of the time things are a lot calmer. I think the other aspect, though, is there's an extent to which this is the most exciting or dramatic of a series of these kind of flashpoints. That if you look back through Labour Party history, every time Labour has lost office, in 1931, in 1951, in 1970, in 1979, the party has turned in on itself. There's been condemnation of the record of the previous government, a kind of allegation of betrayal or sellout by the people at the top, and a kind of grassroots insurrection saying we could have held on to power, we could have achieved more if we'd been more socialist. Ed Miliband kind of managed to fudge that and stop it happening for 5 years by perhaps being part of that move about going the whole hog. And the fact that he put it off has meant that it's bigger now that it has happened. But it's basically the repetition of a pattern, and they're very old kind of divisions and stuff. Like some constituencies, you can look back through history and they would have been nominating the same sides, NEC candidates, back to the 1950s or whatever. Others change position. But there are people around. I've sat down and had a cup of tea with Lord Donoghue, who was head of policy for Harold Wilson, and he told me, he said, oh, it's very interesting you're running Labour First. I ran the campaign for democratic socialism in the early 1960s. Let me tell you about the card index that I had to map who the delegates were at every constituency around the country. And it was basically telling me how he had done my hobby, or the job that I do unpaid outside of work, 60 years ago. And it wasn't massively different other than the technology has changed. But the important thing is that people can, the ideological strands and factions can move around the people, and the people can move. So Roy Hattersley, for instance, has basically said the same things all his political life. They put him on the right of the Labour Party when Foot was leader, but they put him on the left of the Labour Party when Blair was leader. Tony Benn moved from the Gateskellite right to the left just because he read a bit of Marx one Christmas in 1970, if you read his biography. A lot of people who were, some Bennite people were being really consistent, like John Landsman or Pete Wilsman, are the same people that were organising in the early 80s and now involved in organising Momentum. But loads of others of them were very red in tooth and claw, hard left people like Patricia Hewitt in the early 1980s, doing stirring speeches at conference, attacking the leadership. They end up being Blairite cabinet ministers 20 years later because people develop politically. I'm not saying they all develop rightwards either. Some people move to the left.
Things, in my experience, things are normally much calmer in the Labour Party than this. And there are always debates and always arguments and there are always factions, but things are much calmer than this. And actually, it isn't the case that, you know, you go to some event, Labour Party event like conference, and, you know, you see, if you're on the left, you see a Blairite and you hate each other. Actually, people who are around the Labour Party and have been for years have got friends from all across different factions, and they get on pretty well, and they, you know, find shared issues and common issues to talk about. And I actually think what this has done, this coup, this fight, has basically caused the collapse of the soft left within the party. And I think that's really bad news for the Labour Party, because the soft left has always been the anchor of the party. It's been the thing that holds it together. And what actually you've found now is, because it seems like a battle between, like, it's being portrayed as a battle between Blairites and Corbynites, the soft left has been kind of like the parting of the Red Sea, pardon the pun, and people have just joined a side, and the soft left is no longer there. So it means that there's no kind of centre holding the party together. And I think that's why it's in such a difficult state at the moment. And I think once this is all over, and please God, let it be over, I think that there needs to be, in order to keep the party together and to keep it working, there needs to be some kind of reconciliation about how we bring that back together, because otherwise I think the Labour Party will be in serious trouble.
So on that basis, and given the complicated set of forces, how likely do you think a split is going to be coming up in the Labour Party, Jeremy?
I probably think a split is more likely than they think it is. I mean, partly than Ellie and Luke think it is, probably. There are obvious reasons it may not happen, but I think it's very difficult to see how we go back after the vote of no confidence. I mean, a large number of the PLP really absolutely assumed that Jeremy would resign after that, and he hasn't, and that creates an unprecedented situation. So I think. I'm going to say what I think the motivations for a split would be, is that if the split can take the majority of the Parliamentary Labour Party with it, they will become the official opposition. They'll be able to attract quite high levels of funding. They'll have high levels of media support. And I think, although I completely agree that the Blairites are a kind of minority, but I think they're a minority that, as we've described at different points in their history, have succeeded in hegemonising most of the soft left. They succeeded in persuading most of the soft left to go with them, even if it was somewhere they didn't really want to go. And I don't see much evidence of that really having changed recently. So I think it is quite plausible that there could be a split, because I think the temptations for it to be were significant. I think the anger from the grassroots at the MPs is really serious now, and a lot of them are going to face the threat of deselection, even if Momentum and Jeremy's leadership don't advocate for that, which they probably won't. So I think I find it quite hard to imagine that the PLP are in large numbers of existing PLP members are just going to sit there waiting to get deselected. I mean, obviously, large numbers of them won't. I mean, obviously, there'll be different motivations from within different groups. And I think the old right, I'm sure, won't split or won't want to split. And I think partly because here we would have some analytical differences. I mean, the account Luke's given, which is a totally plausible account. I mean, it is the kind of new right, is the old right's view of history. And there's good evidence for supporting it, which is that these things are sort of cyclical, that what's going now is a response to a Labour defeat, and that inevitably we go through these periods when there's a left resurgence. And yeah, the old right, I think, is, on good basis, has seen its historic mission as kind of, you know, holding the fort and holding the line until the party comes to its senses and it can win an election again. And my own view would be there's a lot of truth to that, but I also think that part of what's going on is a set of responses to a much deeper crisis of parliamentary democracy in Britain, the fact that it simply cannot represent the views of a highly complex society in the way that it once might have been able to, and the fact that I think the problem for the soft left is that it's not just committed to a particular programme, it's also historically committed to a particular strategy, and that strategy has been attempted multiple times now and has never, ever succeeded. Like, it's the strategy of attaching a relatively progressive social democratic programme to a sort of respectable leader, like, who presents himself as a moderate. It was tried by Kinnock, it was tried by Miliband, it was tried to a large extent by Brown in 2010, and it just doesn't work. And I think the differences in orientation between around the question of, well, what is the political strategy in response to that are so great that I find it quite hard to see. I find it quite hard to see the party staying together. There are all kinds of reasons, which I'm sure we're about to hear, like why it might stay together, why there might not be a split. But I tend to think that, broadly speaking, most commentary at the moment is saying, of course there won't be a split, there can't be a split, all the reasons for it, against it, are so obvious. But my response to that tends to be, if you are someone who predicted Jeremy Corbyn would be leader of the Labour Party 2 years ago, then you have the authority to say you know what's going to happen and that nothing else is going to change now. I would say, given that none of us predicted that, none of us really know what the hell is going on, and I would say the imminent logic of the processes which led to the election of Jeremy Corbyn seems to me to lead to a place where it's very hard to imagine the Labour Party existing in its current form. That despite the fact that as a lifelong Labour member, I hope we can. I hope we can hold the Labour Party together. I hope it doesn't split.
So, Ellie, do you have a more positive view of what might happen next?
No. No, actually, I do. I think that's... I'm not sure whether I agree with that, but I think it's a very plausible analysis of what might happen. I suppose the reason why I if you'd have asked me 2 months ago, I would have said that a split was definitely going to happen, no question. Stephen Bush, who is a Blairite, also would have agreed with me about that on that point then. I don't know what he thinks now, but I think now
he says there isn't going to be a split.
Oh, right.
Okay. He said to me a week ago.
So yeah, like a couple of months ago, it really felt like there was one coming. Now everybody seems to have gone off that idea, you know, and I think the first past the post electoral system means that, and a lot of polling shows that basically a split would kind of destroy both sides, really. So it's sort of being assumed now that no one's going to be that stupid. But I think what Jeremy was saying there about the vote of no confidence is true. The problem that the MPs face now is that until the next election, until Jeremy Corbyn isn't leader anymore, the Tories and the media will just keep drumming home the fact that, you know, you don't have confidence in this guy, how can the electorate? And I think they'll find that quite unbearable. I don't really know how the Labour Party is supposed to function on an administrative and organisational level after the vote, after such a massive vote of no confidence that even goes down to a local level. Like, hundreds of councillors have also declared no confidence in Corbyn. So I don't really, it's not so much about ideals as much as it is about, for me, about how it actually can function as an organisation in that environment. I don't really know how that's possible. So I think a split is not definite, but I don't think anybody should be complacent about it. I think the alternative, if there isn't a split, which is the small but enthusiastic and vocal Blairite faction, will continue to... I think that if there isn't a split, they will try to run the party into the ground and disrupt the party to the extent that people will eventually, like, they're hoping that it will just fizzle out, this kind of enthusiasm. I think that what they would hope is that they will make the party so dysfunctional that it will continue to lose and lose and lose. And you might have this kind of hard rump of leftists who will stay loyal to Jeremy, but actually the majority of people just don't like constant defeats and they'll just sort of give up. So I think that if there isn't a split, that's what's going to happen. I think it's really not in the Labour Party's best interests to split at all. I think the idea of a progressive alliance with other parties is very interesting, but I don't think the left will do very well without a Labour Party in general. So I don't think anybody should be complacent about that.
And finally, Luke, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I don't think there's any immediate prospect of a split. I think things will get worse before they get better in terms of some of the internal dynamics in the party, because this is just, it's an insoluble question. A leader that doesn't have the confidence of his MPs, but they can't yet find the winning formula to win in the country. I think the way the my guys will eventually win back the leadership will be when they learn to recruit, because the bit where I kind of disagree with Jeremy is I actually think there's a lot more people out there on the centre left that are basically moderate and are not party members who could be attracted to sign up and be registered supporters on members with the right leadership candidate who inspired them. I don't know who that person is at the moment. I think for the vast majority of people on the right wing of the party look at what happened in history with the SDP and just think, I'm not going there. That even if they want, you know, I personally wouldn't want to, if there was like a new social democratic party that believed in all the things I believe in. This will sound really perverse, but it's how tribal, you know, I'm a fourth generation Labour guy. My great grandparents helped set up the Labour Party in North Kent. I would rather be in a 10% minority in a party led by Jeremy Corbyn, being like the guy that's a bit annoying that keeps saying, why don't we go back to what we were, than be on the national executive or general secretary or something of some breakaway that wasn't called Labour. I couldn't go home to my mum and dad and tell them that I wasn't in the Labour Party. I'm not going to do that to them. That's the irrational aspect. The rational aspect is the polling that YouGov did as Ellie said, shows that a breakaway on either side would be catastrophic because of the tribal loyalty of lots of voters like me and my mum and dad. So there are so many people still, even though we have a less tribally class-aligned society, that just will vote for whoever is the Labour candidate. That a left breakaway would only get 12 or 13% and the party called Labour would get 20. And the same if there was a right breakaway, it would get 12 or 13% and the party that was still called Labour would get 20. I suspect that although both are not very probable, there is more chance in the medium term of a left breakaway, because if you are a John McDonnell or a Jeremy Corbyn, the idea of being in a party that gets 10% of the vote and maybe several dozen MPs sounds really quite impressive compared to what was the size of the campaign group. Whereas for people that are used to aspire to government and being a big hegemonic party on 40% or whatever, it sounds absolutely catastrophic. But they're not going to do that at the moment while they're in a position to win. So I'd end with what I think it was. Was it Frank Chappell, who was the Electricians Union leader, said to Shirley Williams, who was one of the founders of the SDP. And he said, Shirley, if you think you've got the political strength and resources to create a totally new centre-left party, then you also have the ability to regain control of the Labour Party. And he said, and if you haven't got the political strength and resources to regain control of the Labour Party, you certainly won't have the ability to set up anything new that lasts long term. And he was right, because the SDP ended up, you know, with the tragedy of people like Vince Cable that had been Labour special advisors sat in a Tory cabinet. That's not how I'm going to end my political activism.
Okay, so we've covered a very, very broad range of history and ideas of the Labour Party, and we will have more of a chance to go into those in some of the later podcasts, but we have reached the end of our time now, so thank you all very much for a fascinating discussion. I know that all of you are quite active online, so can you just let us know where we can follow more of your ideas and things like that? Jeremy?
JeremyGilbert.org.
Thank you. Ellie?
I tweet as Miss Ellie May, but please do not argue with me about Jeremy Corbyn on Twitter.
I tweet as @LukeAkehurst, and I have a column that usually comes out on a Tuesday or sometimes a Wednesday morning at Labourlist.
Fantastic, thank you. So Jeremy and I will be back next month. In the meantime, don't forget to subscribe for free on iTunes or in the podcast app of your choice. To get new episodes, just search for Beginner's Guide to the Labour Party. If you want to help the podcast and help other people discover the show, please do leave us a rating on iTunes. My name is Holly Rigby. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Yo, sometimes I have to laugh to stop me from crying. Cosmetically the block changed, but there still be violence. The war on drugs still going on. Corner still pumping, strong money still. Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree.
That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.